Chapter 19. Three Women. The wind was out of the north, with the sun not yet fully above the horizon, which the locals said always meant rain, and a sky full of clouds certainly threatened as he made his way across the Molhara. The particular men and women in the common room of the Wandering Woman had changed. There were no Suldam or Damani this time, but the place was still full of Shonchan and pipe smoke, though the musicians had not yet appeared. Most of the people in the room were breakfasting, sometimes eyeing the bowls uncertainly as if unsure what they were being asked to eat. He felt that way himself about the strange white porridge Ebu Dari liked for breakfast. But not everyone was intent on food. Three men and a woman in those long embroidered robes were playing cards and smoking pipes at one table, all with their heads shaved in the fashion of lesser nobles. The gold coins on their table caught Matt's attention for a moment. They were playing for high stakes. The largest stacks of coins sat in front of a tiny black-haired man, as dark as a Noth, who grinned wolfishly at his opponents around the very long stem of a silver-mounted pipe. Matt had his own gold, though, and his luck at cards had never been as good as at dice. Mistress Anan, however, had gone out on some errand or other while it was still dark, so her daughter Mara said, leaving Mara herself in charge. A pleasingly plump young woman, with big pretty eyes the same hazel shade as her mother's, she wore her skirts sewn up to mid-thigh on the left side, something Mistress Anan would not have allowed when he was staying there. Mara was not best pleased to see him, frowning as soon as he approached her. Two men had died by his hand in the inn when he was staying there. Thieves who were trying to split his skull, to be sure, but that sort of thing did not happen at the Wandering Woman. She made it clear she was happy to see the back of him when he moved out. Mara was hardly interested in what he wanted now either, and he could not really explain. Only Mistress Anan knew what was hidden in the kitchen, so he devoutly hoped, and he certainly was not about to bleed out the information in the common room. So he made up a tale about missing the dishes the cook turned out, and eyeing that blatantly sewn skirt, he slipped in the implication that he had missed looking at her even more. He could not understand why exposing a little more petticoat was scandalous when every woman in Ebu Dar walked around showing half her bosom. But if Mara was feeling rakish, maybe a few blandishments might ease his path. He gave her his very best smile. Giving him half an ear in return, Mara seized a passing serving maid, a smoky-eyed cat of a woman he knew well. "Air Captain Yulin's cup is almost empty, Kyra," Mara said angrily. "You are supposed to keep it full. If you can't do your job, girl, there are plenty in Ebu Dar who will." Kyra, several years older than Mara, made her a mocking curtsy and scowled at Matt. Before Kyra could straighten her knees again, Mara turned to grab a boy who was walking by carefully balancing a tray piled with dirty dishes. "Stop lollygagging, Ross," she snapped. "There is work to be done. Do it or I'll take you out to the stables, and you will not like that, I tell you." Mara's youngest brother glared at her. "I can't wait till spring when I can work on the boats again," he muttered sullenly. "You've been in a bad skin ever since Friel got married, just because she's younger than you, and you haven't been asked yet." She directed a cuff at his head that he easily eluded, though the stacked cups and plates rattled and nearly fell. "Why not just pin up your petticoats at the fishing docks?" he shouted, darting off before she could slap at him again. Matt sighed as she finally turned her full attention to him. Pinning up petticoats was a new one on him, but from Mara's face he could guess. Steam should have been jetting from her ears. "If you want to eat, you must come back later. Or you can wait if you like. I don't know how long before you can be served." Her smile was malicious. No one would choose to wait in that common room. Every seat was taken by a Shonchan, and there were more Shonchan standing, enough that the aproned maids were forced to weave their way carefully, holding trays of food and drink aloft. Kyra was filling the dark little man's cup and offering him the sort of sultry smiles she had once offered Matt. He did not know why she had soured on him, but he had as many women in his life as he could handle at the moment. What was an air captain, anyway? He would have to find out later. I will wait in the kitchen, he told Mara. I want to tell Enid how much I enjoyed her cooking. She started to protest, but a Shonchan woman raised her voice demanding wine. Grim-eyed in blue and green armor, with a helmet carrying two plumes under her arm, she wanted her stirrup cup right then. All of the maids seemed occupied, so Mara grimaced at him one last time and went scurrying, trying to set her face in a pleasant smile. And not getting far with it. Holding his walking staff wide, Matt flourished a bow to her retreating back. The good smells that had mingled with sweet pipe smoke in the common room permeated the kitchen, roasting fish, baking bread, meats sizzling on the spits. The room was hot from the iron stoves and the ovens and the fire in the long brick fireplace, and six sweating women and three potboys were dashing about under the orders of the chief cook. Wearing a snowy white apron as if it were a tabard of office, and wielding a long-handled wooden spoon to reign over her domain, Enid was the roundest woman Matt had ever seen. He did not think he could have gotten his arms around her had he wanted to. She recognized him right away, and a sly grin split her wide olive face. "So you found out I was right," she said, pointing the spoon at him. "You squeezed the wrong melon, and it turned out the melon was a lionfish in disguise, and you were just a plump grunter!" Throwing back her head, she cackled with laughter. Matt forced a grin. "Blood and bloody ashes, everybody really did know." I have to get out of this bloody city, he thought grimly, or I'll hear them bloody laughing at me the rest of my life. Suddenly his fears about the gold began to seem foolish. The gray floorstone in front of the stoves appeared firmly in place, no different from any other in the kitchen. You had to know the trick in order to lift it. Lopin and Nerim would have told him if so much as a single coin had vanished between their visits. Mistress Anan likely would have tracked down and skinned the culprit if anyone tried thieving in her inn. He might as well be on his way. Maybe Aludra's willpower would be weaker at this hour. Maybe she would give him breakfast. He had slipped out of the palace without waiting to eat. So as not to rouse curiosity about his visit, he did tell Enid how much he had enjoyed her gilded fish, how it was better than that served in the Tarasin Palace, without having to exaggerate even a whisker. Enid was a marvel. The woman positively beamed, and to his surprise lifted one out of the oven onto a platter just for him. Somebody in the common room could just wait, she told him, setting the platter at the end of the kitchen's long work table. A wave of her spoon brought a stout potboy with a stool. Looking at the gold-encrusted flatfish, he felt his mouth watering. Aludra likely would be no weaker now than any other time. And if she was upset over being disturbed so early, she might not give him breakfast. His stomach rumbled loudly. Hanging his cloak on a peg beside the door to the stable yard, and propping his walking staff beneath, he tucked his hat under the stool and turned back his lace to keep it out of the platter. By the time Mistress Anan came in through the door to the stable yard, swinging her cloak off and shaking rain onto the floor, little remained beyond a tangy taste on his tongue and fine white bones on the platter. He had learned to enjoy a number of odd things since coming to Abu Dhar, but he left the eyes staring up at him. The things were on the same side of the fish's head. Another woman slipped in behind Mistress Anan as he dabbed his mouth with a linen napkin. She closed the door behind her quickly and kept her damp cloak on with the hood pulled well up. Rising, he caught a glimpse of the face inside that hood and nearly knocked his stool over. He thought he covered well, though, making a leg to the women, but his head was spinning. "It is well you are here, my lord," Mistress Anan said briskly, handing her cloak to a potboy. "I would have sent for you otherwise. Enid, clear the kitchen, please, and watch the door. I need to speak with the young lord alone." The cook briskly herded the undercooks and potboys out into the stable yard, and despite their muttered complaints about the rain and wails about the food burning, it was clear they were as accustomed to this as Enid. She herself did not even glance at Mistress Anan and her companion again before hurrying through the door into the common room, with her long spoon held up like a sword. "What a surprise," Jolene Mazza said, tossing her hood back. Her dark woolen dress, with a deep neckline in the local style, fit loosely, and looked worn and frayed. You would never have thought it from her carefree attitude, though. When Mistress Anan told me she knew a man who might take me with him when he left Ebu Dar, I never guessed it was you. Pretty and brown-eyed, she had a smile almost as warm as Kyra's, and an ageless face that screamed Aes Sedai. With dozens of Seanchan just the other side of a door, guarded by a cook with a spoon. Removing her cloak, Jolene turned to hang it on one of the pegs, and Mistress Anan made an irritated sound in her throat. "That isn't safe yet, Jolene," she said, sounding more as if talking to one of her daughters than to an Aes Sedai. "Until I have you safely..." Suddenly a commotion rose at the door to the common room, Enid protesting in a shout that no one could enter, and a voice almost as loud in Seanchan accents, demanding that she move aside. Ignoring the protests of his leg, Matt moved faster than he thought he ever had in his life, grabbing Jolene by the waist and plunking himself down on the bench by the door to the stable yard, with the Aes Sedai in his lap. Hugging her close, he pretended to be kissing her. It was a fool way to try hiding her face, but all he could think of, short of throwing her cloak over her head. She gasped indignantly, but fear widened her eyes when she finally heard the Seanchan voice, and she snaked her arms around him in a flash. Praying for his luck to hold, he watched the door open. Still protesting loudly, Enid backed into the kitchen, thumping away with her spoon at the Sojin with a wet cloak hanging down his back, who was pushing her ahead of him. A heavy-set scowling man with a stub of a braid that did not even come close to reaching his shoulder, he fended off most of her blows with his free hand and seemed to ignore the few he could not. He was the first Sojin Matt had seen with a beard, and it gave him a lopsided look, running down the right side of his chin and up the left to stop dead at the middle of his ear. A tall woman with sharp blue eyes and a pale stern face followed him, flinging back an elaborately embroidered blue cloak, held at her throat by a large silver pin shaped like a sword, to reveal a pleated dress of a paler blue. Her short dark hair was cut in the bowl, the rest shaved off all the way around above her ears. Still, she was better than a Suldam with a Damani. A little better. Realizing the battle was lost, Enid backed away from the man, but by the way she gripped her spoon and glared, she was ready to leap on him again in a heartbeat if Mistress Anan gave the word.
"A fellow out front did say he did see the innkeeper going round the back," the Sojin announced.
He was looking at Satala, but eyeing Enid warily.
"If you be Satala Anan, then know this do be captain of the Green Lady, Eginan Tamaroth. And she do have an order for rooms signed by the High Lady Surath Sabel Madarath herself."
His tone altered, becoming less a pronouncement and more the voice of a man wanting accommodations.
"Your best rooms, mind, with a good bed, a view of the square out there, and a fireplace that no does smoke."
Matt gave a start when the man spoke, and Jolene, perhaps thinking someone was coming toward them, moaned against his mouth in fear. Her eyes shone with unshed tears, and she trembled in his arms. The Lady Eginan Tamaroth glanced at the bench when Jolene moaned, then grimaced in disgust and turned so she could avoid seeing the pair. It was the man who intrigued Matt, though. How in the light did an Ilioner come to be Sojin? And the fellow looked familiar somehow. Likely another of those thousands of long-dead faces he could not help recalling. "I am Satala Anan, and my best rooms are occupied by Captain of the Air, Lord Abeldar Yulin," Mistress Anan said calmly, unintimidated by Sojin or blood. She folded her arms beneath her breasts. "My second best rooms are occupied by Banner General Furik Kharid of the Death Watch Guards. I don't know whether a captain of the Green outranks them, but either way, you will have to sort out for yourselves who stays and who has to go elsewhere. I have a firm policy of not expelling any Seanchan guest, so long as he pays his rent." Matt tensed, waiting for the explosion. Surath would have her flogged for half that, but Eginan smiled.
"It's a pleasure to deal with someone who has a little nerve," she drawled.
I think we'll get on just fine, Mistress Annan, so long as you don't take nerve too far. Captain gives the orders, and crew obeys, but I never made anyone crawl on my deck. Matt frowned. Deck? A ship's deck? Why did that tug at something in his head? Those old memories were a nuisance sometimes. Mistress Annan nodded, never taking her dark eyes from the Shan Chan's blue. As you say, my lady, but I hope you'll remember that the Wandering Woman is my ship. Luckily for her, the Shan Chan woman had a sense of humor. She laughed. Then you be captain of your ship, she chuckled, and I will be captain of the gold. Whatever that meant. With a sigh, Aginin shook her head. Light's truth, I don't outrank many here, I suspect. But Suroth wants me close at hand, so some move down and somebody moves out, unless they want to double up. Suddenly she frowned, half glancing toward Matt and Jolene, and her lip curled in distaste. I trust you don't let that sort of thing go on everywhere, Mistress Annan. I assure you, you will never see the like again under my roof, the innkeeper replied smoothly. The Sojin was frowning at Matt and the woman on his lap, too, and Aginin had to tug at his coat sleeve before he gave a start and followed her back into the common room. Matt grunted contemptuously. The fellow could pretend to be outraged like his mistress all he wanted. Matt had heard about festivals in Ilion, though, and they were almost as bad as festivals in Ebu Dar when it came to people running around half-clothed or less. No better than Daco Vale or those Shay dancers the soldiers went on about. He tried to ease Jolene from his lap when the door swung shut behind the pair, but she clung to him and buried her face on his shoulder, weeping softly. Enid heaved a great sigh and sagged against the work table as though her bones had softened. Even Mistress Annan appeared shaken. She dropped under the stool Matt had vacated and put her head in her hands. Only for a moment, though, and then she was back on her feet. Count to 50 and then get everyone in out of the rain, Enid, she said briskly. No one would have known that she had been trembling a moment earlier. Gathering Jolene's cloak from its peg, she took a lone splinter from a box on the mantelpiece and bent to light it in the fire beneath the spits. I will be in the cellar if you need me, but if anyone asks, you don't know where I am. Until I say otherwise, no one but you or I goes down there. Enid nodded, as though this was nothing out of the ordinary. Bring her, the innkeeper told Matt, and don't dawdle. Carry her if you must. He did have to carry her. Still weeping almost soundlessly, Jolene would not loosen her hold on him or even lift her head from his shoulder. She was not heavy, thank the light, yet even so a dull ache began in his leg as he followed Mistress Annan to the cellar door with his burden. He might have enjoyed it in spite of the throbbing if Mistress Annan had not taken her time about everything. As though there were no Shan Chan within 100 miles, she lit a lamp on a shelf beside the heavy door and carefully blew out the splinter before replacing the tall glass mantle, then laid the smoking splinter on a small tin tray. Unhurriedly producing a long key from her belt pouch, she undid the iron lock and, finally, motioned him to go through. The stairs beyond were wide enough to bring up a barrel, yet steep, vanishing into darkness. He obeyed, but waited on the second step while she drew the door shut and relocked it, waited for her to take the lead with the lamp held high. The last thing he needed was a tumble. "Do you do this often?" he asked, shifting Jolene. She had stopped her crying, but she still held tight to him, trembling. "I mean, hiding Aes Sedai." "I heard whispers there was a sister still in the city," Mistress Annan replied, "and I managed to find her before the Shan Chan did. I couldn't leave a sister to them." She glared back over her shoulder, daring him to say different. He wanted to, but he could not make the words come. He supposed he would have helped anyone get away from the Shan Chan if he could. And he owed a debt to Jolene Mazza. The Wandering Woman was a well-stocked inn, and the dark cellar was large.
Aisles stretched between barrels of wine and ale stacked on their sides, high slatted bins of potatoes and turnips that stood up off the stone floor, rows of tall shelves holding sacks of dried beans and peas and peppers, mounds of wooden crates holding the light alone knew what. There appeared to be little dust, but the air had the dry smell common to sound storerooms. He spotted his clothes, neatly folded on a cleared shelf, unless someone else was storing garments down there, but he had no chance to look at them. Mistress Annan led the way to the far end of the cellar, where he set Jolene down on an upturned keg. He had to pry her arms free in order to leave her huddled there. Sniveling, she pulled a handkerchief from her sleeve and dabbed at red-rimmed eyes. With her face blotchy, she was hardly the image of an Aes Sedai, never mind her worn dress. "Her nerve is broken," Mistress Annan said, putting the lamp on a barrel that also stood on end, the bung in its end gone. Several other empty barrels stood about the floor where others had been removed, awaiting to return to the brewer. It was as close to a clear space as he had seen in the cellar. "She's been hiding ever since the Seanchan came. The last few days, her warders have had to move her several times when Seanchan decided to search a building instead of just the streets. Enough to break anyone's nerve, I suppose. I doubt they will try to search here, though." Thinking of all those officers upstairs, Matt had to concede she was probably right. Still, he was glad it was not him taking the risk. Squatting in front of Jolene, he grunted at a stab of pain up his leg. "I will help you, if I can," he said. How, he could not have said, but there was that debt. "Just be glad you were lucky enough to dodge them all this time. Teslin wasn't so lucky." Snatching the handkerchief from her eyes, Jolene glared at him. "Luck," she spat angrily. If she had been other than Aes Sedai, he would have said she was sullen, sticking her lower lip out that way. "I could have escaped. It was all confusion the first day, as I understand. But I was unconscious. Fenn and Bleric barely managed to carry me out of the palace before the Seanchan swarmed over it, and two men carrying a limp woman attracted too much attention for them to get anywhere near the city gates before they were secured. I'm glad Teslin was caught. Glad. She gave me something. I'm sure she did. That is why Fenn and Bleric couldn't wake me. Why I have been sleeping in stables and hiding in alleys, afraid those monsters would find me. It serves her right." Matt blinked at the tirade. He doubted he had ever heard so much pure venom in a voice before, even in those old memories. Mistress Annan frowned at Jolene, and her hand twitched. "Anyway, I'll help you as much as I can," he said hurriedly, rising so he could move between the two women. He would not put it past Mistress Annan to slap Jolene, Aes Sedai or no Aes Sedai, and Jolene looked in no mood to consider the possibility of a Damani being upstairs to feel whatever she did in retaliation. It was a simple truth. The Creator made women so men would not find life too easy. How in the light was he to get an Aes Sedai out of Ebu Dar? "I'm in debt to you." A tiny frown wrinkled Jolene's brow. "In debt?" "The note asking me to warn Nynaeve and Elaine," he said slowly. He licked his lips and added, "The one you left on my pillow." She flicked a hand dismissively, but her eyes, focused on his face, never blinked. "All debts between us are settled the day you help me get outside the city walls, Master Cawthon," she said in tones as regal as a queen on her throne. Matt swallowed hard. The note had been stuck into his coat pocket somehow, not left on his pillow, and that meant he was mistaken about who he owed the debt to. He made his leave without calling Jolene on her lie, a lie even if only by letting his mistake pass, and he left without telling Mistress Annan either. It was his problem. It made him feel sick. He wished he had never found out. Back in the Tarasin Palace, he went straight to Tylin's apartments and spread his cloak over a chair to dry. A pounding rain beat against the windows. Putting his hat atop one of the carved and gilded wardrobes, he toweled his face and hands dry and considered changing his coat. The rain had soaked through his cloak in a few places. His coat was damp here and there. Damp. light. Growling in disgust, he wadded up the striped towel and threw it on the bed. He was delaying, even hoping a little, that Thailand might walk in and stab the bedpost so he could put off what he had to do. What he had to do. Jolene had left him with no choice. The palace was laid out simply, if you cared to look at it that way. Servants lived on the lowest level, where the kitchens were, and some in the cellars. The next floor up contained the spacious public rooms and the cramped studies of the clerks, and the third, apartments for less favored guests, most occupied now by Seanchan blood. The highest floor held Thailand's apartments and rooms for more favored guests, like Surath and Tuon and a few others. Except even palaces had attics, of a sort. Pausing at the foot of a flight of stairs hidden around an innocuous corner where they would not be noticed, Matt drew a deep breath before going up slowly. The huge windowless room at the top of the stairs, low ceiling and floored with rough planks, had been cleared of whatever it held before the Seanchan, and the space filled with a grid of tiny wooden rooms, each with its own closed door. Pale iron stand lamps lit the narrow halls between. The rain beating down on the roof tiles was loud here, just overhead. He paused again on the top step and only breathed again when he realized that he could hear no footsteps. A woman was crying in one of the tiny rooms, but no Suldam was going to appear and demand to know what he was doing there. Likely, they would learn he had been, but not until after he found out what he needed, if he was quick. He did not know which room was hers, was the trouble. He walked to the first and opened the door long enough to peek in. An Atha An Mier woman in a gray dress was sitting on the side of a narrow bed, hands folded in her lap. The bed and a washstand, with bowl and pitcher and a tiny mirror, took up most of the room. Several gray dresses hung from pegs on the wall. The segmented silver leash of an Idam ran in an arc from the silver collar around her neck to a silver bracelet looped over a hook set in the wall. She could reach any part of the tiny room. The small holes where her earrings and nose ring had been had not yet had time to heal. They looked like wounds. When the door opened, her head came up with a fearful expression that faded into speculation. And maybe hope. He closed the door without saying a word. I can't save all of them, he thought harshly. I can't. Light, but he hated this. The next doors revealed identical rooms and three more sea folk women, one of them weeping loudly on her bed, and then a sleeping yellow-haired woman, all with their idam loosely stretched to hooks. He eased that door shut as though he were trying to filch one of Mistress Alvear's pies right under her nose. Maybe the yellow-haired woman was not Seanchan, but he was not about to take the chance. A dozen doors later, he exhaled heavily in relief and slipped inside, pulling the door shut behind him. Teslin Baradin lay on the bed, her face pillowed on her hands. Only her dark eyes moved, stabbing at him. She said nothing, just looked at him as though trying to bore holes in his skull. "You put a note in my coat pocket," he said softly. The walls were thin. He could still hear the weeping woman. "Why?" "Elida does want those girls as much as she ever wanted the staff and stole," Teslin said simply, without moving. Her voice still had a harshness to it, but less than he recalled. "Especially Elaine. I did wish to inconvenience Elida, if I could. Let her whistle for them." She gave a soft laugh, tinged with bitterness. "I did even dose Jolene with fork root, so she could no interfere with those girls. And look what it did get me. Jolene did escape, and I..." Her eyes moved again to the silver bracelet hanging on the hook. Sighing, Matt leaned against the wall beside the dresses hanging on pegs. She knew what had been in the note, a warning for Elaine and Nynaeve. Light, but he had hoped she would not, that someone else had put the bloody thing in his pocket. It had not done any good anyway. They both knew Elida was after them. The note had changed nothing. The woman had not really been trying to help them anyway, just to inconvenience Elida. He could walk away with a clean conscience. Blood and ashes. He should never actually have spoken to her. Now that he had actually exchanged words with her. "I'll try to help you escape if I can," he said reluctantly. She remained still on the bed. Neither her expression nor her tone of voice changed. She might have been explaining something simple and unimportant.
"Even if you can remove the collar, I will no get very far, perhaps no even out of the palace. And if I do, no woman who can channel can walk through the city gates unless she does wear an idam. I have stood guard there myself, and I do know."
"I'll figure out something," he muttered, raking his fingers through his hair.
"Figure out something? What?" "Light, you don't even sound as if you want to escape."
"You do be serious," she whispered,
so low he nearly did not hear.
"I did think you only did come to taunt me."
Slowly she sat, swinging her feet down to the floor. Her eyes latched onto his intently, and her voice took on a low urgency.
"Do I want to escape? When I do something that does please them, the Suldam do give me sweets. I do find myself looking forward to those rewards."
Breathy horror crept into her voice.
"Not for liking of sweets, but because I have pleased the Suldam."
A single tear trickled from her eye. She inhaled deeply.
"If you do help me escape, I will do anything you ask of me that does not encompass treason to the white."
Her teeth snapped shut, and she sat up straight, staring right through him. Abruptly, she nodded to herself.
"Help me escape, and I will do anything you ask of me," she said. "I will do what I can," he told her. "I must think of a way."
She nodded as though he had promised an escape by nightfall.
"There do be another sister held prisoner here in the palace. Edesina Azedin. She must come with us."
"One other," Matt said. "I thought I'd seen three or four, counting you. Anyway, I'm not sure I can get you out, much less..."
"The others do be changed."
Teslin's mouth tightened.
"Guisin and Mylan, I did know her as Sharain Kamenel, but she do answer only to Mylan now. Those two would betray us. Edesina do still be herself. I will no leave her behind, even if she do be a rebel."
"Now look," Matt said with a smile, soothingly. "I said I will try to get you out, but I can't see any way to get two of you."
"It do be best if you go now," she broke in again. "Men are no allowed up here. And in any case, you will rouse suspicions if you do be found."
Frowning at him, she sniffed.
"It would help if you did not dress so flamboyantly. 10 drunken tinkers could no attract as much attention as you do. Go now, quickly, go."
He went, muttering to himself. Just like an Aes Sedai, offer to help her, and the next thing you knew, she had you scaling a sheer cliff in the middle of the night to break 50 people out of a dungeon by yourself. That had been another man, a long time dead, but he remembered it, and it fit. Blood and bloody ashes. He did not know how to rescue one Aes Sedai, and she had him trying to rescue two. He stalked around the innocuous corner at the foot of the stairs and almost walked into Tuon.
"Damani kennels are forbidden to men," she said, peering up at him coldly through her veil. "You could be punished just for entering."
"I was looking for a windfinder, high lady," he said hastily, making a leg and thinking as fast as he ever had in his life. "She did me a favor once, and I thought she might like something from the kitchens. Some pastries or the like. I didn't see her, though. I suppose she wasn't caught when..." He trailed off, staring. The stern, judicial mask the girl always wore for a face had melted into a smile. She really was beautiful.
"That is very kind of you," she said. "It's good to know
You are kind to Domani, but you must be careful. There are men who actually take Domani to their beds.
Her full mouth twisted in disgust.
You would not want anyone to think you are perverted.
That severe expression settled on her face again. All prisoners would be executed immediately.
Thank you for the warning, High Lady, he said, a little unsteadily. What kind of a man wanted to bet a woman who was on a leash?
He disappeared then, as far as she was concerned. She just glided away down the hall as if she saw no one. For once, though, the High Lady Tuan did not concern him at all. He had an Aes Sedai hiding in the cellar of the wandering woman, and two, wearing Domani leashes, who all expected Matt Bloody Cawthon to save their necks. He was sure Teslin would inform this Edesina all about it as soon as she was able. Three women, who might start getting impatient if he failed to waft them to safety soon enough. Women liked to talk, and when they talked enough, they let slip things better left unspoken. Impatient women talked even more than the rest. He could not feel the dice in his head, but he could almost hear a clock ticking, and the hour might be struck by a headsman's axe. Battles he could plan in his sleep, but those old memories did not seem much help here. He needed a schemer, someone used to plotting and crooked ways of thinking. It was time to make Tom sit down and talk. And Julin. Setting out in search of either, he unconsciously began humming I'm Down at the Bottom of the Well. Well, he was, and night was falling, and the rain well and truly coming down. As often happened, another name drifted up out of those old memories. A song of the court of Takedo, in Farashel, crushed 1,000 years ago and more by Arthur Hawkwing. The intervening years had made remarkably little change in the tune itself, though. Then it had been called The Last Stand at Mandanhar. Either way, it fit too bloody well.